Okay, this is the fourth part of the Burned Over District. So far we've talked about Shakers and Quakers and the Oneida community of free love, open complex marriage people.
Sex cult, please.
Sex cult, the sex cult. And we talked about Mormons, another arguably sex cult. Mm. Sorry, Mormons. Go back and listen to that episode for the context of that.
Not incorrect.
So now it's all kind of been culminating to this total free-for-all of spirituality and mysticism, and that's what we're about to explore.
Yes.
This is the alternate dimension. Spiritualism is commonly said to have begun on March 31st, 1848, in Hydesville, a hamlet outside of Rochester. Joseph Smith was dead, William Miller's apocalypse had failed, and New York was ripe for a new obsession. The Fox household had allegedly experienced mysterious noises for quite some time, but on March 31st, they made first contact with a spirit. Ooh. Now, this wasn't an angel or some great luminary speaking from heaven. This was just a mundane deceased person. when asked questions, the spirit knocked deliberate responses, yes or no. Playing 20 questions with the phantom rapper, they soon learned that he was the spirit of a man who had long ago been murdered in the house and buried there.
I love that he's a regular person, but I feel like I need to know, how did they discover him in the first place?
So I guess the girls had just been working on this system of, like, asking him these questions, and then they started hearing these responses and then called their mom to check it out. So it was just kind of this spontaneous, like, leap into being able to communicate with the spirits.
But they'd been hearing weird, ghoulish noises beforehand?
That's as the lore says. That's okay. What people say.
I didn't know if they were hearing noises and then started asking questions, or if they're just that inquisitive. They're like, there must be a ghost here. This is New York.
I don't know that there's, like, a documented history prior to the communication of the ghost.
He's
Something tells
me
there's probably not. But I'm telling you the story as it's told, okay? So the following day, which was April 1st, April Fool's Day, the entire town caught ghost fever, and a frenzied search of the property eventually found bones of various kinds.
Of various kinds.
Yeah, some records that you'll find claim that they found the man's body that day, a complete male skeleton in the basement that matched every detail. Most of the reports you find from the time say that they found bones.
Just bones.
Yeah, and it was like a farm, so yeah. I'm going to say there's probably some bones around.
Yeah. No, I mean, was it all in one location, or did they just find it?
It was like in the cellar, like around a cellar, they found bones the next day.
Not that unusual to find bones in any kind of dig, really.
Yeah. And it's not specified that it was this man's skeleton until years later.
Gotcha.
In these records. Wherever the Fox sisters went, they not only inspired a intense fascination in ghosts, they also inspired people to become fellow psychics, particularly amongst Quakers and ex-Millerites.
Wow.
First, they visited Auburn, and then Rochester, and then by 1850, virtually every city and town in New York had mediums of their own.
Wow. So they were teaching, or was it that they were, like, inspiring people to discover their already endowed talents?
So they would go around and they would do these, what I would call performances,
yeah,
in front of the town, of communicating with whatever spirits happened to be around.
Yeah.
And basically everywhere they went, other people developed this ability.
Right. I'm jealous.
Yeah. Ghost communications most frequently came in the form of knocking noises, which is called rapping in all the texts at that time. Tables levitating or spinning, which is called table turning. So something you often hear that happening at seances is the table lifts up and starts spinning.
Mm-hmm.
And automatic writing, which is a process of channeling ghost writing, but it is indistinguishable from a person sitting at a table writing.
Yeah.
in just 2 years, New York proved itself to be absolutely riddled with ghosts from border to border.
Listen, I have no judgment for these people. As someone that played many games of light as a feather, stiff as a board, I really get it.
Yep. Right. Yeah. A lot of people have experienced some kind of phenomenon like this.
Yeah.
So I have to ask, how do we explain this explosion in psychic phenomenon? How did everyone have this gift? I have a few reasons why, I think, from looking at the historical record. So first, as we've discussed at length now, many New Yorkers had already discovered their ability to speak to God and to angels, and it wasn't so uncommon to have spoken to a deceased luminary by this point. Many of the founding fathers had been contacted in various ways, so New Yorkers had already established that you could speak to deceased or invisible figures that were around. And then secondly, the familiarity with the techniques that would allow communication with the hereafter, these techniques had become widespread by this point. Since the beginning of the century, upstate New York experienced a phenomenon called sleeping preaching. This is something we haven't gone into yet, but this was going on during a lot of the other stories. So astonished family members noticed that their loved ones, particularly young women, would fall asleep normally and then begin to preach with loud, clear voices, vivid sermons, complete with biblical quotes that could rival the most energetic evangelists on the scene.
This was an actual phenomenon.
Yeah. This was multiple people who developed this gift, mostly young women. So for 5 years of her life, starting in 1811, Rachel Baker preached fire and brimstone as wildly as any traveling preacher, complete with quotations, despite her lack of education, but only when she slept. For some time, she suffered fevers, fits, and spasms, and then she slipped into a coma. This is a narrative that we're becoming very familiar with at this point. From the point of her recovery, she preached loudly while she slept. Doctors were fascinated. The medical profession had only just begun to experiment with the mind, and it was slowly moving psychology from being a branch of philosophy into being an experimental science. She underwent extensive battery of testing in New York City that produced a 300-page treatise on sleep, dreams, and trance states that became an important scientific text.
Wow.
Yeah. By this time, crowds of 100 or more came to listen to her while she lay flat in her bed with her eyes closed.
So her parents turned their house into a church at night?
Yeah, basically, yeah. And I have to wonder to what extent this was a way to escape gender roles, because similar to the public universal friend, she couldn't obtain a license to preach, and she couldn't rightfully be a traveling preacher. And I think this conceit of her being asleep, or, you know, that just that wild leap of faith that is involved in that, that allows her to escape this gender role.
Because I wonder if the thought at the time was, if she's asleep, then it's not really her. That God is like acting through her body, but it's not her.
Yeah, it's definitely meant to be, like, the voice would be these like big booming authoritative voices, and then when the women were awake, they would have their meek little womanly voices. So yeah, I think this is also part of it. It's like, yeah, channeling, essentially.
Yeah. Oh, these poor women.
I know. It was a tough time.
Yeah.
By 1816, the treatment given to her by her doctor involved cold water dousing and dosing her with camphor and castor, both of which induce cramping and diarrhea. They're both toxic. We don't take them anymore.
Yeah.
And a lot of opium was also part of her treatment.
Oh, my God. This poor woman.
Yeah. She was soon cured after this battery of testing went
on. Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah. Baker was just the first, though, to experience these nighttime trances. Some sang, some chanted, and most spoke with a voice and a persona that was very different from their waking self. By the time mediums began to hold seances mid-century, techniques for channeling and this kind of automatic speaking and then also automatic writing had already been established amongst Protestant Christians in New York. A third point, New York still had many fraudsters practicing illusions. We talked about the Smith family. There were plenty of families like this around.
Yeah.
And many were working in dowsing or selling services to find hidden things. using mystical rituals. Like I said, the Smith family was charged with glass looking because of his hats, rocks in a hat way of studying things.
Scrying, scrying, my preferred term.
So some part of the new mediums were surely people who are already working in a trade similar to this.
Yeah. Okay? They just like adjusted slightly.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is just a new avenue. So fourth, science, and especially the burgeoning science of psychology, had an intense interest in trance states, and a field that we now call parapsychology. Sort of ESP, this kind of thing, telekinesis.
I've never heard of that term, actually.
In the late 18th century, Franz Mesmer made a big splash in the scientific community with his theories about animal magnetism by inducing a trance state, then called mesmerism. Now we generally associate this with hypnotism. Mesmer claimed that he could manipulate the invisible force that possesses all living things and channel it for the purposes of healing.
And this was named after him?
Yeah, Franz Mesmer.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's where that's where we get mesmerized.
Wow!
Yeah.
Okay.
In 1784, a committee of the French Academy of Science, that included Benjamin Franklin as one of its members, concluded that there was no such animating force that could be detected or manipulated, thereby excluding Mesmer from mainstream science.
What do they even know?
Yeah, I know. And it's worth pointing out, like, this is also the birth of electromagnetism, the study of that. It's like a completely new force that people are still trying to harness. Benjamin Franklin, one of the earlier workers in this area, but he could find no such similar force to magnetism coming from life.
Pure haters.
Right. but regardless, this idea that animating energy can be manipulated, this remains at the center of New Age medical practice. And this is something you see in alternative medicine across the board today.
Mm. Chakras, I think.
Yeah. This is absolutely part of that same idea. Mm. Practitioners of mesmerism were called magnetizers.
Yes.
Because they worked on this supposedly magnetic animal force. The process of mesmerizing often involved the patient holding magnets to influence the energy running through them. Despite Mesmer's fall from grace within the medical community, magnetizing became a widely accepted medical treatment amongst regular people. Mm. Given that mainstream medicine at that time treated more or less everything with doses of poisonous materials that would make you have diarrhea or vomit or blister or such, this was pretty much all that mainstream medicine was at that time. With that in mind, just sitting in a room holding magnets may be the better treatment option for a lot of people.
Probably slightly cheaper, too, I would think.
Yeah. George Washington invested in home magnetizers. He bought rods of brass and iron, even though his friends Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin disapproved.
And laughed at him.
Yes. Thomas Jefferson, in particular, had read that it was unsafe for women to be around. And so that was his main objection to it.
It interferes with your uterus or something?
I believe so. It's hard to say.
I want to know in which room in his house he stored his magnets.
I know. I like to imagine that he had his, a back room. Sometimes you read, sometimes you magnetize.
Some velvet furniture, a chandelier, some nice books.
Of course. German scientists became fascinated with the case of Friederike Hauff, who after an illness and coma, which is our standard trajectory now, she spoke in strange languages, produced cosmic diagrams, conferred messages from the dead, and diagnosed illnesses while she was in her mesmeric state.
Wow.
Although research of this kind was largely shunned by the scientific community, it influenced concepts of the subconscious. And people like Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung really were interested in this, although they rephrased it rather than being a way to look into the great beyond, it was a way to look into the deeper parts of the brain.
Yeah.
In the 1830s, animal magnetism experienced a revival in folk healing. It had kind of gone underground for a little while. Now it came back in the 1830s. By now, it was a venerated alternative medicine. Magnetizers frequently induced trances as public exhibitions. Mesmerized patients seemed to draw knowledge from impossible sources. Often, magnetists would pair up with their more talented clairvoyants in order to showcase the full spectrum of magnetism's power.
So they were predicting the future of what the person would say?
It was a lot of reading things and knowing things that they shouldn't have been able to know in that moment.
Okay.
The most powerful magnetists could get rid of the equipment altogether and simply use their animal magnetism to influence others. And it became such that they could do this from miles away. And so mail order magnetism became a thriving business in the 1830s.
How convenient.
Yeah. So you just magnetize from halfway across the country and still heal that way.
Armchair magnetism.
Yes. fifth and finally, spiritualism had a philosopher who fit ghosts and spirits into a remarkably beautiful and accessible vision of the world. Mm. And it's his work that most influences our modern ideas of spirituality and like ghosts and spiritualism. His name was Andrew Jackson Davis. And at the age of 13, he heard a melodious voice tell him to travel to Poughkeepsie. And he somehow managed to convince his father to make that move. So this earned him
that
the nickname.
That is a devoted father.
I know, it really is. I don't know how a 13-year-old in the 1800s convinces his dad to move the family. But this earns him the nickname the Poughkeepsie Seer.
I love that.
In 1843, at the age of 17, Davis first demonstrated his powers. After the town had hosted a lecture on the wonders of mesmerism, Davis demonstrated to the owner of a tailor shop, William Levingston, that he could see things behind his head while he was in a trance state. Mm. One remarkable demonstration included reading a newspaper behind him with his eyes closed.
Damn.
I know. And there's no way to do that. There's no way to know what the newspaper said before you get mesmerized. This aroused great interest, and he and the owner soon turned the demonstrations into profit by selling medical prescriptions that were devised by Davis and then manufactured by his friend the tailor.
Oh, yeah. There was a whole business plan involved in this.
And before long, a universalist minister, Gibson Smith, got in on the action as well. And soon they had a well-polished system. Smith would do a universalist preaching, and then Davis would demonstrate his abilities, and he would prescribe cures, and then Levingston would create and sell these medicinal cures to the patients.
Do we know what kind of medicinal cures they were?
Yeah, I've got a particularly strange one here in a second. Yes. The resulting performance strongly resembled shows that faith-healing televangelists would perform throughout the 70s and 80s, and I mean, to some extent, until today.
Yeah, for sure.
Davis must have tired of these performances that he gave, because on March 6th, 1844, he was transported 40 miles away in his sleep.
Whoa.
Yeah. He spent most of the hike back in a trance, and he came upon a graveyard inhabited by two spirits. One was the Roman physician Galen, and the other was the Christian mystic Swedenborg. I'll go into each of these guys.
Just kicking it together.
Yeah. So Galen handed Davis a magical staff that opened up like an umbrella to reveal a bunch of boxes around a central pole. Each box had the name of a disease in an unknown language, and inside of each box was the cure for that disease. So unfortunately for Davis and for the rest of us, as he was exiting the graveyard, he got stuck on a fence post. So he handed the staff back to Galen while he got himself off of this post, and when he asked for it back, Galen refused, telling him, quote, "In a due season thou shalt return, and then it shall be thine."
I mean, why does this sound so familiar?
I know.
And why do all of the most fabulous otherworldly gifts come in a box? Like, I just really have a problem with that.
Yeah.
You can't come up with a better carrying system that allows for a man to get himself unhooked from a fence.
I know. And
a satchel.
I know.
A backpack.
I just like, I like to imagine like he, his, like the classic, like the back of his underwear got caught on it and he's like hanging off of this fence post fighting like in a Looney Tunes. But anyway, yeah, he had to hand the staff back to Galen. Galen didn't give it back to him. And then as far as I can tell, he was never able to acquire the staff with the cures to everything on it.
Wow.
I know. As you mentioned, this incident closely mirrors Joseph Smith trying to collect the golden plates.
Yeah.
It's easy to see how power comes from being the only person who can interact with the secret source of truth.
Yeah.
When he returned from this experience to Levingston's house, he announced that he would no longer give clairvoyant demonstrations because now he had a higher calling, which was to heal people. Now fully capable of mesmerizing himself, he no longer needed a mesmerizer. Davis became a renowned faith healer. Most cures were standard herbal recipes, but some were more eccentric. For example, to a deaf person, he recommended catching 32 weasels, boiling their hind legs to extract an oil, which would then be dripped into the ear twice a day. And the recipe specifies, then you will be mostly cured.
32 weasels.
Yeah.
Those poor weasels.
I mean, one wonders how many weasels you need to get all the way cured, though. And what their hind leg juice consists of. So these were the kind of cures that he dispensed. It was also during this time that he developed a broader philosophy based on the visions he experienced in his trances. And these were heavily based on the writings of Swedenborg, who's the other spirit who he met in the graveyard. Mm-hmm. So Emanuel Swedenborg was a Christian mystic in the late 17th century. And he influenced many of the ideas we've discussed throughout this episode. He's kind of been lurking in the background. He was one of the first to come up with a really like vivid and descriptive vision of the afterlife that he gave, that he apparently saw in his visions. Mm-hmm. He was a Swedish noble, and he experienced a spiritual awakening that allowed him to see the kingdom of heaven as well as the pits of hell. And he was able to converse with angels, demons, and other supernatural figures. He described apocalyptic visions and added greatly to the Christian mystical canon with his vivid descriptions and some cryptic predictions that he made.
And these were taken as like accepted additions, or was it like some people thought it was great, some people thought he was a crackpot?
He was very much in the fringe and like kind of on the occult side of everything. He was also pretty influenced by existing like occult ideas about the afterlife and everything. Mm-hmm. Christian occult movement things from going back to the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. But you can kind of look at him as akin to help me out, the Paradise Lost guy, Milton.
Oh yeah,
as a kind of Milton, in that he like really expanded this like canon of like what we imagine heaven and hell to be like.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah. So Davis now combined Swedenborg's complex afterlife and knack for description to his own universalist concepts and some other ideas of his own. So universalism was a new concept that was coming around into its own in New York in this time amongst Quakers and certain other progressive Christian sects. It solved the problem of evil and eased the horror that sits at the center of Christianity by proposing that no person is doomed to hell forever. Rather, we continue our moral journey after we die. There were many ideas about how this process would take place or what it would look like, but the general concept is that souls progressively become purified either by being more holy or by completing their knowledge, getting rid of ignorance, and then eventually this will make them good enough to be accepted into heaven. So all people's fate eventually lands them in heaven. It's just a matter of the path you take to get there.
The former Catholic in me cannot accept that.
I know. ironically, this is more or less the same idea as purgatory. And Protestants really spoke out against purgatory as this Catholic invention. So it's ironic that like 300 years later into this Protestant development, they produce an essentially similar concept. And I think the reason has to be because hell is too horrifying to think about. Like, to be tortured forever for the decisions I make on earth is just, like, too much.
It's outrageous.
And it's really hard to cite, to square that with a loving God who created you individually and cares about your fate.
I think it's also hard to square it just with the difficulties of regular life.
Yeah.
If
everybody has to make moral compromises from time to time.
Everyone exists in a moral gray area at some point, if not multiple points throughout their lives. And to think that that is your fate is just, who wants to be a part of that system?
Yeah. So I think Christianity in its many incarnations has had to deal with this, like, this terror and come up with some way to explain it one way or the other. And, you know, for Catholics, it was indulgences and purgatory.
Yeah.
For Universalists, it was, as you mentioned with reference to the Mormons, kind of this like Eastern reincarnation idea almost, that you continue to experience things that will further purify you until you can become one with the greater being.
Oh, yeah. They definitely lifted that idea from...
Yeah. Yeah.
Some much older religions.
With all this in mind, I'm going to quote Davis here so that he can explain his vision of the world, because it really is beautiful. So this is how he saw his patients. The whole body was transparent as a sheet of glass. It was invested with a strange, rich, spiritual body. With a strange, rich, spiritual beauty. It looked illuminated as a city. Every separate organ had several centers of light, beside being enveloped by a general sphere peculiar to itself. And I did not see the physical organ only, but its form, aspect, and color also, simply by observing the peculiar emanations surrounding it. For example, I saw the heart, surrounded by a general combination of living colors, with special points of illumination interspersed. The articles and ventricles, together with their orifices, gave out distinct flames of light, and the pericardium was a garment of magnetic life, surrounding and protecting the heart, while also in performance of its functions. The pulmonary or respiratorial department was also illuminated with beautiful flames, but of a different magnitude and color. The various air chambers looked like so many chemical laboratories.
Oh my, I'm starting to sense now why he was able to convince his dad to move.
No, yeah.
He's so good at that. He's
a beautiful speaker, or at least yeah. writer.
And also, it's interesting to me because this really, that made me think of auras and how yes. that's still such a powerful concept.
This is absolutely where we get auras from.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is how he saw the world at large. He says, "It was very, very beautiful to see everything clothed with an atmosphere. Every little grain of salt or sand, every minute plant, flower, and herb, every tendril of the loftiest trees, their largest and minutest leaves, the weighty mineral and the ponderous animal forms existing in the broad fields before me. Each and all were clothed with dark or brown or gray or red, blue, green, yellow, or a white atmosphere, divided and subdivided into an almost infinite variety of degrees of intensity, brilliancy, and refinement. And, mark that fact, in each mineral, vegetable, and animal, I saw something of man. In truth, the whole system of creation seemed to me like the fragments of future human beings. In the beaver, I saw in embryo one faculty of the human mind, in the fox another, in the wolf another, in the horse another, in the lion another. Yea, verily, throughout the vast concentric circles of mineral, vegetable, and animal life, I could discern certain relationships to and embryological indications of man."
I'm starting to like this guy.
Beautiful speaker.
Yeah. I also, it's interesting to me because it feels like he's also borrowing from like indigenous American traditions here, saying yeah. that the earth and the animals and humans are all inevitably interconnected.
Yeah. It does seem very much like a return to animist thinking of yeah. like there being a spirit in every kind of thing around you. Even if it's inanimate, it has some kind of spirit to it.
I was ready to call him a kook, but I'm walking it back.
So in this, we get a synthesis of universalist progressivism. Mm. We get evolution ideas in here, and we get this Christian perfectionism, along with something totally new of Davis's creation, which is this like beautiful artistic language that he brings to it. Mm-hmm. Davis created a visual language for progressive universalism that connected mankind to the rest of creation in a much more real way than it had been discussed in Christianity before. This idea brings ancient paganism and Asian polytheism into this Christian milieu, imagining all things, animate and inanimate, as having a spiritual content that interacts with every other piece of spiritual content.
Yeah.
Davis later claimed that on March 31st, 1848, he heard a voice say, quote, "Brother, the good work has begun. Behold, a living demonstration is born."
Softly, softly, hear the rustle of the spirit's airy wings. They are coming down to mingle once again with earthly things. They're rapping and they're tapping, rap, tap, tap, to wake our napping. Rap, tap, tap, lost friends are near you. Rap, tap, tap, they see and hear you.
In fact, the Hydesville phenomenon fit into Davis's work perfectly. Suddenly, there was a way for the wider world to experience this alternate dimension that up to this point only clairvoyance had access to. Mm-hmm. And that's the real takeaway of what made the spirit wrappings different from everything that came before it, is that this allowed anyone standing in the room to hear the spirit directly and to see into this alternate dimension.
Gotcha. And was Davis super popular in his time after he went solo? After he dumped his two boy band friends?
Yeah. Once he had elevated from like Parlor Trick to Spirit, Faith Healer, he did have a wide following at
that
point.
He pulled a full Beyonce.
I did. And that's when he became the Poughkeepsie Seer.
I see. Oh, okay.
One can only imagine what Mesmer would have thought. Mesmer was about 50 years dead at this point, but one can only imagine what he would have thought to know that the world was now experiencing physical proof of intelligent, invisible, and animating forces left over from humanity.
Pretty pissed about how he was treated, I would think.
Yeah. All right, who are you going to call? It's this next section.
I can't wait.
Andrew Jackson Davis continued to develop his ideas in his periodical, The Universalium. He described the transit of the soul before and after death in grandiose terms. He described six heavens surrounding Earth through which the soul passes, slowly shedding its negative elements. The first heaven after death he described as the summer land, which was a pleasant place where souls could shed the material concerns from life. And this is where mostly children would go before spirits of their loved ones would kind of join them and take them to other areas.
Okay, so not everyone goes through all six.
No, I don't think so. I think it depends on what you need to shed from your life.
Oh, okay.
He formulated a credo that heavily informs New Age thinking today. Key points of this include that God is both male and female, that all matter and spirit are intertwined, that the planet exists to support and evolve human beings, that human beings are progressive result of evolution, and that death is a purifying process by which the spirit is freed from its chains in this world. Davis said, quote, life in the next world is substantially the same as life in our present existence.
Ooh.
And this was kind of a big jump for a lot of Christian thinking.
Yeah.
Later in the 1850s, Davis became concerned about the focus on the more obvious parts of spiritualism, particularly the spooky seances that were becoming popular.
Let us have our ghosts. Go away.
He insisted that spirit communication provided proof and a window into the afterlife, but those who seek spiritual entertainment are simply wasting their time.
Ooh.
Yeah. In the 1880s, after a lifetime of practicing his eccentric forms of medicine, he earned an orthodox medical diploma from a real medical school, and he set up a practice in Boston as a family doctor.
Whoa.
Yeah, so he went mainstream at the end of his life.
He actually went to medical school. He was like, I'm this powerful religious leader. I can read newspapers behind my head and cure people.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go to medical school and then just set up a family practice.
Yeah, so if we want to ask the question we asked about Joseph Smith and John Humphrey Noyes and some of the others, I would place him pretty far on the true believers side of the scale, because it seems like he had very little interest in like developing and coddling a following or anything like that, or really taking advantage of people.
Yeah,
it seems
like
he was much more focused on like actually trying to help people.
Yeah. Doesn't sound like he had a single child bride.
Yeah. Right. Very unusual.
He didn't wear a uniform?
No. Well, I think he did have a doctorate, a faith doctor.
He speaks too soon.
Yeah, now that I think about it, I think he had a faith doctorate kind of uniform.
Still better than some of the uniforms, the dandyish uniforms we talked about.
Yeah,
before.
And also the fact that he like left, you know, after, you know, in his youth for just like a year or so doing these like really over the top like traveling circus type things. He quit that pretty quickly.
Yeah,
which I think also speaks something to his character of like what he wanted his life's practice to look like.
And that he didn't want to take advantage of people.
Yeah.
Ugh. Finally, a character that comes out fairly unscathed in his storytelling.
Yeah, I feel pretty good about Andrew Jackson Davis. Yeah, Davis's intellectual approach provided a framework for spiritualists, but his disapproval of the performative aspects, that went largely ignored.
Yeah, New York, I get it.
Yeah. New York caught fire with spiritualism, especially amongst progressives. And the connection between progressives and ghosts seems to lie mostly in like the organic roots that they shared. The Fox family belonged to a sect of radical Quakers that had been ejected from mainstream Quakerism by advocating abolition, as in invading the South to end slavery rather than hoping that it ends by itself or rejecting its spread other less warlike ideas.
Only the Quakers would call that radical. Right.
But because Quakers were pacifists, this idea of invading
yeah.
the other half of the country to end slavery was too far.
Yeah. I love the Quakers.
Even as the Civil War approached, most critics of slavery favored a gradual emancipation that would include compensation for slave owners. This was still an idea that was mostly talked about. We're going to buy out all the slaves from the South. This was not the case for New York abolitionists, who felt strongly that slaves should not be traded for money.
Mm-hmm.
They continued pushing against the tide of national policy as the Civil War approached, and more concessions were given to slave owners regarding the rights of fugitive slaves. As the Civil War approached, Southern slave owners more and more could repossess their slaves who had escaped to the North, mostly due to Supreme Court decisions.
Great.
Garrett Smith, for example, he raised money from middle and upper class New Englanders, and he would buy land to give to black New Yorkers. And the theory was that only property and land ownership would ensure long-term freedom for black populations in America. Yeah. And he donated most of the land that he had inherited to this cause. So this was a lifelong thing that Garrett Smith did.
Mm.
It's also worth mentioning that Smith's daughter, Elizabeth Miller, along with her friend, Amelia Bloomer, led the dress reform movement, which claimed that Victorian clothing placed impossible demands and excessive costs on women, that women shouldn't spend all their time and money making clothing. And instead, they wore short pants, similar to the women of the Oneida community, and these came to be called bloomers, after Amelia Bloomer.
Oh, see, I thought the primary thing was going to be corsets that they were going after.
Yeah, yeah, that was the corset as well was okay. part of their, because those were also, I mean, they were often made with whalebone and things yeah. that were very expensive. So corsets were not a very accessible garment.
A limited resource, you yeah. could say.
Yeah. Isaac and Amy Post of Rochester, they operated one of the last stops in the Underground Railroad, and they sheltered fugitives there before sending them to freedom in Canada. Their most famous guest was Frederick Douglass, and he called them, quote, two people of all abounding benevolence, the truest and best of the Long Island Quakers. And with the support of the Post, Douglass was able to stay in Rochester, and he started an anti-slavery newspaper, the North Star, which became a real center point of abolition literature.
Mm-hmm.
The Posts were equally involved in women's rights. In July of 1848, Amy attended the Women's Rights Convention that had been held in nearby Seneca Falls. Frederick Douglass was that convention's only black member, and he gave a stirring speech in favor of women's suffrage rather than simply women's rights. He said women need the right to vote if they want to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
The landmark convention happened just 3 months and 25 miles away from the Hydesville Wrappings. I get a sense of how close in time and space feminism and ghosts were happening. Later that year, the Post invited the Fox sisters into their home in Rochester. And it wasn't the first time. The Post had rented a space in Rochester from the Fox family before they lived in Hydesville. So these families were already good friends.
Like intertwined and really. Okay.
Yeah. The Post became immediately fascinated with the ghost phenomenon. And they became some of the greatest proponents of it. And this was in part because of a personal tragedy. Isaac had lost his first wife 4 years into their marriage, and his first son at the age of 5 in a threshing accident, which threshing is a piece of farm equipment. It's a gory death.
Oh, that's terrible.
Together, Isaac and Amy had lost their only daughter also at the age of 5. So one of the first spirits that the Foxes were able to contact was the Post's daughter, Matilda, who assured them that she was happy living in the spirit world.
Oh.
Yeah. Isaac held many seances with the Fox girls and introduced them to magnetism, which only increased the powers that they had. Through magnetism, Leah Fox, she was 20 years older than her sisters, and she served as their manager. She now also developed powers.
Oh.
Which allowed her to channel spirits by writing, and then eventually she could vocally channel.
Wow.
When in a mesmerized state. The Post popularized the sisters in exhibitions in Rochester progressive circles and then across New York. And these tours became highly profitable. So that's part of why the progressives are so intertwined with this ghost phenomenon.
And were the foxes already sort of famous by this time, and they just further pushed them out, or was this the catalyst to them becoming famous?
I think you basically have the Fox Sisters in Hydesville, really getting people excited, and there's been whispers of what's going on in Hydesville, and then they come to Rochester, and the Post give them the platform to really to take that to a national stage.
Got it.
Yeah. Isaac then also became a medium. he specialized in automatic writing, putting himself in a trance and then writing for Quaker idols such as George Fox, who founded it, and William Penn. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson would sometimes write through Isaac Post. Sometimes deceased defenders of slavery and Southern politicians would write through him to apologize for the cause that they supported in life.
How convenient.
And he collected these writings in his 1852 Voices from the Spirit World, complete with an introduction by none other but Benjamin Franklin.
Wow.
I know. Like 70 years dead or something at this point. This was apparently the first step in a mental decline, though, because Lucretia Mott, his friend, wrote a few years later that he had gone insane from the spirit communications. Spiritualism became pop culture. Songs and dances were composed, such as the 1853 hit Spirit Rappings. occultists and scientists alike dove into testing and examining ghost and psychic phenomenon. Mary Todd Lincoln was already interested in this. She had already supported mediums and worked with mediums to commune with her deceased children. But after her husband died, she became a major benefactor of spiritualism, and she hosted international occultists who would come through New York. Across the Atlantic, spiritualism found a very powerful supporter in the physician and author Arthur Conan Doyle. He was one of the biggest spiritualist supporters and popularizers. Virtually every progressive of the time made some comment on spiritualism. They had to. It was part of their life. Frederick Douglass once wrote a letter to the Post to apologize for having used the word atrocious at their party. He clarified that he meant that the spirit was being frustratingly coy, and he wasn't referring to the company of the Post themselves.
Oh, frustratingly coy.
Douglas never warmed to the ghosts. He was always an anti-ghost guy. Lucretia Mott, similarly, she wrote that, quote, "Your knockings are probably a humbug." Susan B. Anthony largely ignored spiritualism, but happily spoke at spiritualist conventions through her whole life. But I couldn't find any statement she made directly about whether she believed or not. I think she basically avoided the conversation. she essentially considered everything other than suffrage to be a distraction from what she wanted to talk about.
That's kind of fair.
Yeah. The abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, meanwhile, said that he had to believe that invisible spirits, not of this mundane sphere, performed phenomenon that he had seen. Mm. And this seemed to be the more general perspective on it, was that seances and spirit communicators were communicating with something, whether that be some aspect of living humans or just an invisible force. That seemed to be the more mainstream position that most people took.
Okay.
Meanwhile, spiritualism was approaching a coherent philosophy. The French educator Alan Kardec created a systematic approach for extracting information from mediums, and he codified the teaching of the spirit world in a series of books taken from interviews with mediums. Kardec, in fact, was an alias that was given to him by his spirit guide, which was an entity called Truth. His twist on spiritualism, which is called Spiritism, involves the idea that spirits are reincarnated through various forms of life while the soul is being purified, which brings it even closer to Hindu ideas of reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
Kardec wasn't the only one codifying spiritualism. Thomas Lake Harris was a universalist minister and admirer of Andrew Jackson Davis, although he wrote him a letter and Davis told him that he wasn't a real medium, and so then there was a rift between them.
Rude.
Yeah.
Because he had been the one to write Mediuming 101.
Yeah.
So he was the authority.
Yeah, pretty much.
Mediuming for dummies.
Yeah. So he was definitely an authority on the subject.
Okay.
So after he had been rejected by Davis, he denounced Davis, and he formed a community near Poughkeepsie of 60 of his own spiritualist converts. They were five Eastern Orthodox clergymen and 20 Japanese samurai who joined him in his community.
That's actually who they were?
Those are actually living people that joined him.
I thought it was just Americans that were like, from now on, I'm a Japanese samurai in this community.
No, they were actually ejected because this is happening at the same time as the Tokugawa regime fell and Japan is opening up to American trade for the first time.
Okay.
And so samurai have now become this like fallen class. They're like similar to in Europe, their nobility with no money and no power left to them anymore. So they sort of spread out around the world. So anyway, 20 of them came and joined Thomas Lake Harris.
How cool must he have felt.
Yeah, I know. He taught that through a technique called open breathing, one could imbibe spiritual influences, which would have various advantageous effects to your physical and your spiritual health. He was likely already familiar with yogic breath practice. We definitely know that he was reading various texts from the East. That's called pranayama. He elevated his own technique over these Indian practices, though, by warning that overexposure to the spirit realm leads to confusion and ultimately polytheism.
Oh, no, not that.
Harris maintained his belief in a Christian God at the center of the spiritual realm, and he limited his followers' access to these spiritual realms to protect them from these malevolent other spirits.
Yeah, I don't know, too. Like, if I assume so, and I should know this, but does Zen Buddhism have a version of, like, you know, meditation breathing? I would assume so. Like, I wonder if he got some of this from the samurai that were in his ranks.
Yeah, I wonder. I didn't look totally into that. I'm not totally sure the Japan connection, but you would think that there could be Japanese Buddhism.
I'm so sorry for the Zen Buddhists that are listening that I don't know this.
I know. Yeah. Harris wrote his revelations in long lyric poems that were sometimes dictated to him by great poets, including Byron, Keats, Shelley, and Coleridge.
Oh, that's what I would use my medium powers for. Yeah. Someone finally has gotten into some good stuff.
And some were also written by angels, fairies, and Hindu gods.
Yes. I want a fairy poem.
As ghost contact became more and more common, many figures from the past were popular amongst mediums, and their identities became increasingly appropriated. We've already talked about Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin seem to be really popular spirits to call on.
Especially ironic, considering Ben Franklin's point of view on Mesmer.
Thomas Jefferson writing, you know, some of the most deist stuff out there, essentially rejecting Christianity completely. it was common. They were still being influenced by this kind of post-Puritan idea that the world was in this fallen state because of the moral decisions of people, and that they lived in a fallen world.
Yeah.
And that there was a time before civilization that was more pure and more direct and more holy and closer to the source, essentially. And so they imagined, especially native people, non-civilized people, as being closer to this font. And so many of these white middle-class Americans, progressive Americans, started channeling Native American spirit guides. And when they were possessed by Native Americans, they would often, you know, sing and dance and stomp around and do performative racist acts.
Oh, I don't support this.
Yeah. Most of these Native American spirits forgave them for the European invasion of their lands and gave the land freely in a way that only, you know, pure, innocent hearts can truly give. Ugh. Yeah. Little effort was made by spiritualists to provide any kind of restitution to the living descendants of these spirit ancestors that they were claiming. Often spirits were said to be from white American, like pre-Native American white Americans, such as in the Joseph Smith Ancient Jews story.
Ugh.
Or even pre-human races. Sometimes they were said to be frog creatures or semi-human creatures that lived in this land prior to the Native Americans, which then casts American Indians as the invading colonizing force in a case of total projection by these European Americans.
So there were innocent frog people. They were invaded by, like, the long-lost white people of somewhere, depending on who you were.
Typically in this vision, it's then the American Indians are conquering. It's either the ancient white people or the ancient frog people get conquered by American Indians. And so the reversal of that situation is just a, you know, that's just a return to how it should be.
Right.
So that's full on projection as a culture.
Yeah.
Spiritualism had no center and it had no end. It was not located anywhere. Mm. Most of these ideas that form New Age belief came from this later phase of spiritualism. But if there had been a center, it would have been Lily Dale. Lily Dale was a major center of this. On the shores of the Casadega Lake in Chautauqua County, it grew from a summer resort to a semi-permanent community of spiritualism and paranormal enthusiasts.
Oh, I know this name.
Yeah. It centered around the second major American clairvoyant after Andrew Jackson Davis. If Andrew Jackson Davis is number one, this guy Jeremiah Carter was number two. Mm. But he usually presented himself as Dr. Hedges, who was a deceased physician with a great botanical expertise. When he was an old man in 1895, Carter explained that since Dr. Hedges had been inhabiting him, his brain had grown 3 inches.
Like in all directions, or...
Seeping out his ears, I think. Lily Dale continued to grow after Carter's death. Lily Dale was the community that grew up around Carter. It continued to grow after his death.
Oh, okay.
It now includes the Andrew Jackson Davis Lyceum for Children, which you can go to. A hotel, libraries, a healing temple, a maze, a museum, and a fairy trail that goes into the woods.
Ooh, I like the sound of a fairy trail.
I bet. In 1915, the community purchased and transported the Hydesville Cottage onto their site, but it burned down in 1955. Oh. To this day, Lily Dale hosts summer sessions on astrology, sweat lodges, animal communication, crystal healing, astral travel, and a wide variety of other practices. It sits side by side with a religious community called the Chautauqua Institution. This started as a summer gathering of Methodist ministers, and it became a nationwide adult education program that was based on progressive and liberal Christian principles. By the 1920s, there were hundreds of Chautauquas all around the country, and it was these major, adult progressive Christian centers. One of the only that remains is in Boulder, where Jess and I went to school. And it does seem now to, like, there's, like, Chautauqua, there's Boulder, which is very New Age and woo, and then there's Naropa University.
Yeah.
And the three seem to form this kind of, like, New Age spiritualist, educational system.
It's a power triangle, Boulder.
So it seems like over time, Chautauqua institutions have taken on more of the Lily Dale, perhaps, than vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
As spiritualism transformed into New Age, it focused less on the seances and on the performative aspects of spirits. In 1851, less than a decade into the ghost mania, a relative of the Fox family alleged that she had helped fake the spirit wrappings. Many doctors and scientists who attended seances considered ghost phenomena to be tricks, but others became convinced that the phenomena did have material causes. There was some physical explanation for these wild experiences that people had at seances. In 1888, the Fox sisters demonstrated how they were creating the rapping noises. They were popping joints in their feet and ankles.
Really?
Yeah. When their feet were under cabinets, they could even create the impression of a distant or booming knocking.
I'm just trying to think of how they casually got their feet under cabinets.
I know. So they always wore these long black dresses, and seances were pretty much always held at tables.
Right.
So they were able to use their feet.
Sneak a foot out.
And if there's like a wardrobe behind them or something, somewhere that they can get their foot under, then that acts as a resonating chamber and an amp, essentially.
I'm actually really impressed by that. That's talent.
It's a great trick. And I mean, either their mom was in on it from the start, or the first person they successfully tricked was their mom with this trick.
I'm of two minds, too, because I get that some people would find them to be, like, tricksters and taking innocent people's money. But also, can you think of the peace that they probably gave so many parents who'd, like, lost a child or something?
And with,
like,
the Summerlands belief, it's definitely a pretty comfort. I mean, as opposed to the Christian, if they're not baptized, they go straight to hell. Summerland sounds kind of
so
nicer.
Much nicer.
That's true.
Is it all that bad?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I'm definitely of two minds, too. Yeah. I think, because you still have this to some extent. You still have John Edwards was the guy who on Sci-Fi Channel had this communicating with the dead show. And you learn, like, there are all these, like, techniques to cold reading a room. And it's, like, absolutely yeah. this, like, I don't know, the showman trick that yeah. people have been doing forever in carnivals yeah. and stuff. That
like can comedians still be performed. Heckling their own yeah, audience, too. True. Yeah.
And yeah, so John Edwards would go out and he'd be like, oh, I hear spirit, you know, it's got the letter D. Is there anyone in this room with the letter D? And then just by probability, you can find someone in the room yeah. who you're talking to and yeah. deliver these things to. So anyway, you know, there's peace for some people who, you know, go to that. But I also have to look at that. It's just like one of the worst forms of taking advantage of people at their absolute lowest and taking money out of people who are just in this horrible state.
And I'm sure some people extended themselves past what right. they could
and
go.
Some people do get really into that. Yeah. And then I don't know, you see that with grief, people getting really invested in some ideology and giving all their money to it. And
yeah.
those kinds of things. So.
But in these pre-talk therapy days,
yeah,
it must have been nice.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point.
Yeah.
It was, I think, probably a pretty healthy way to express grief as compared to like the medievals would, you know, carve skeletons on everything and write memento mori under it. This is maybe a healthier expression of grief than that. The confession by the Fox sisters explained an experiment that had been performed on them back in 1853 when scientists showed that the girls couldn't create the noises if their feet were exposed from under their long dresses or if they were sat on soft surfaces. They put pillows under their feet and they couldn't communicate with the spirits.
Damn pillows.
Yeah. Mediums met their match in an unexpected enemy, the professional magician. So around this time, body artists, illusionists, and other magicians began professionalizing their art as well. Mm-hmm. At the center of this change stood Harry Houdini, the hugely popular Hungarian immigrant showman. Later in his career, he became interested in debunking mediums. Seances and magic rely on many of the same techniques that magicians do for their shows. So magicians often knew how this paranormal activity was being faked yeah. in a way that other professions didn't.
Yeah.
Some psychics and mediums who had convinced the greatest scientists of their time got then later exposed by Houdini, which is pretty embarrassing if you're like, you know, a main, like one of the top scientists of France had like cleared all of these cases that he was amazed at. He invented the word protoplasm and was really fascinated with the material causes of all these things. Houdini then later proved how most of those case studies were based on simple parlor tricks.
Yeah, that's pretty embarrassing. Yeah. I'm really interested as to why Houdini got really into that, though.
Yeah, and I can definitely view it most clearly as being like a professional concern of his.
Yeah.
Like these are like off books magicians. But I think also there was like a certain ethics to it where he was like, he wanted to impress upon people that they could do great things, like him being able to escape from chains and stuff. This was part of this idea of like showing what the body is capable of. And as like a body artist like this, you know, he's getting dunked upside down in tanks of water covered in chains. It's very dangerous and tricky stuff that he's doing. So I think to some extent he's like, look at all of these people doing like the most basic magician tricks out there, and they're making all this money and they're getting all this press. I'm gonna go out and show them. I think there was some extent to that. And then I think also he was just a committed like skeptic. This was like a worldview that he wanted to get across, was that like you need to be skeptical and aware that there are lots of tricks in this world.
Maybe a little bit too of not wanting to share credit with like a spiritual realm too.
Yeah,
like,
I think
people
so.
That would be amazed by his tricks and say that he was yeah. blessed or being, you know, something like that. He's like, no, I'm just amazed.
No, yeah, I just yeah. held my breath for 10 minutes a day for the last 3 years. Figured this out. Yeah. More than once, he made a fool of Conan Doyle in the press. Conan Doyle was frequently bringing up cases of spirit photography, where images of deceased persons get double exposed. There's a really famous one with Lincoln in the background of Mary Todd Lincoln that's supposed to be a picture of a spirit. It's just a double exposure yeah. in the frame. So before his death, Houdini promised to his wife that he would contact her within 10 years after dying, if it was possible. And 10 years later, she extinguished the candle that she kept burning beside his photograph, saying, 10 years is long enough to wait for any man.
Yeah. Get it, girl.
So this work of the debunking magician continues with people like the Amazing Randy, who just unfortunately died just recently. He exposed Uri Geller live on The Tonight Show. I'll put a link in the blog. It's hilarious. You should check it out. And Penn and Teller, who frequently produce pieces explaining how illusions are performed and encouraging skepticism in general.
Yeah.
I think one of my favorites that I saw was them doing the ball trick, but the balls were, the cups were clear plastic, so you could see exactly what was inside of them at every moment of the trick.
Yeah. Do they still have a show?
I think so. I mean, definitely for a long time. It was like Fool Us or something.
Yeah.
Get people up there and they're like, we know every trick, show us a new trick. Yeah. So I think work like that still continues to encourage people to be skeptical and to know the difference between like really good performance art and magic and spirits and things. Today, the belief in ghosts mostly lives on in fiction. Pseudoscientific ghost claims, though, saw a resurgence in the 2000s with the A&E show Ghost Hunters, which depicts these centuries-old parlay tricks as scientifically verifiable evidence.
Don't you dare tell me that was fake.
It goes into great detail laying this pseudoscientific narrative on top of these ghost hunts.
And it's great TV. How dare you?
It's great TV. It was really popular. And this led to an explosion of other ghost reality shows, TVs and movies that produce ghosts through a pseudoscientific lens and try to convince the general public that there is scientific evidence for ghosts, which there isn't. But this is something that kind of kills me as a horror fan, because it seems like every ghost movie that comes out has to spend like half of its time talking about why ghosts are real. Like, I watched one the other day that, like, seriously, it talked about Swedenborg for like an hour. And I was like, this isn't scary.
Just give me my ghosts, though.
Yeah, I don't need to be convinced that a Christian mystic made all this real or whatever. Just give me to the ghosts. But probably the most effective popularizer of ghosts is the famous spiritualist Dan Aykroyd. Aykroyd's great grandfather was a dentist and mystic and a corresponder with Conan Doyle. So mystical dentist.
Two professions that often go hand in hand.
Yeah. And he was one of the founding members of the Lilydale Society. Aykroyd's grandfather experimented with receiving spirit communications on radios. That was his big deal. Mm. And following in their footsteps in the 1980s, Aykroyd started working on a script that would raise interest in parapsychology. He paired his comedic chops with a very real belief in ghosts and produced the massively popular and influential film Ghostbusters. And Ghostbusters really did reinsert ghosts in the minds of Americans in a big way.
I'll be honest, I did not know that he personally really believed in ghosts, though.
And I think the script was initially much more straight, and then as it went through the writing process, his fellow comedians like encouraged him to push it more into the realm of fiction. And that franchise is still going strong. There's a reboot that's supposed to come out this year.
Who
2021
doesn't love Ghostbusters?
All right, so here's so that's the spiritualism. Now I want to go through a few honorable mentions.
Yeah.
I met a lot of really bizarre characters throughout this that I didn't have time to give a whole section to, so I'm just going to hit some of these people pretty quickly that boggled my mind.
Yeah.
And I want this to shed a little light on like the background radiation of what's going on throughout these other stories that you've been hearing.
Yeah.
There are all these other wildlife lives that are popping up and disappearing. So Paschal Beverly Randolph, this section is sex and mirrors. Paschal Beverly Randolph, 1825 to 1875, was a mixed race black man, and he had a well-respected career as an occultist and sex magician. Although
a what now?
Sex magician. Although the details of his childhood are obscure, in part because he told so many conflicting stories throughout his life, it's clear that he was well-traveled before he settled in Portland, Maine, to be a barber and dyer, which was one of the only trades available to him because he was black. After being magnetized by Andrew Jackson Davis himself, Randolph came to be accepted as a gifted clairvoyant physician and a psychophrenologist, which is a psychiatrist who works in phrenology, I guess.
Which is the head shape thing.
Yeah, which is the head shape thing. Yeah. Which is another like common pseudoscience that's being used for medicine at this time.
Yeah.
Randolph conveyed several experiences, often from departed loved ones. In one notable instance from the Persian icon Zoroaster, or Zarathustra, where he apologized for praising the Persian gods over the universal god of nature that Randolph preferred.
Interesting.
He began to write about the non-existence of evil and the universality of the god of nature. He proudly reserved the right to criticize Bible quotes, which he referred to as his Whack Moses brand of spiritualism. Randolph became a darling of the New York spiritualist community and traveled the world, becoming a respected orator, an expert on the spiritual realm, and a major occultist. The occult is also kind of on the edges of all of these stories we've been telling. He really immersed himself in that community as well.
Okay.
During this time, he incorporated perfectly legal drugs into his spiritual practices, including opium, usually in the form of laudanum, and with pills and cocktails of cannabis sativa, a drug that he claimed to be especially potent for expanding the consciousness.
And was this just on himself, or was he giving this to followers in like moments of, like when they were listening to his sermons or whatever?
I don't know if it would be like everyone would be high at the gatherings, but I think if you were in the inner circle, you were experimenting with rituals and stuff with drugs and sex.
Okay.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have called it a sermon. He would have hated that.
Yeah. Probably. As his career continued, Randolph accumulated children and debt, and he eventually denounced spiritualism in favor of born-again Christianity. He became a born-again Christian. Yeah, I'm sorry. He even went so far as to burn bridges with his abolitionist and progressive friends in the 1860s, as the Civil War is looming and then going on, by emphasizing his white slaveholding ancestors. He was a descendant of the first governors of Virginia.
Yeah.
Around that time, he popularized a lot of ideas that have become grist for conspiracy theories that are around today. And these included ideas such as the destruction of a planet between Mars and Jupiter had knocked Earth off its axis and caused the biblical flood. In the future, the sun would melt the polar ice caps, Earth's axis would realign, and a new millennium would begin. You hear things like this in, well, most recently there was the 2012 like apocalypse predictions that everybody got really into. This was an idea that you heard a lot in that.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's been a lack of sex magic in this explanation so far.
I'm going to kill him first and then I'll tell you.
Oh, damn it. Okay.
continuing to tour the world, kept on the run by his New York debtors, his life came to a sudden end at age 49 due to an apparent suicide that might have been a murder. It's hard to tell from the documents.
And you're just going to leave us all hanging like that?
That's pretty much all I've got on that.
How dare you?
Sorry. His greatest legacy, though, was his writing on sex, his Mysteries of Eros. He, like most of his time, most people of his time, feared masturbation and emphasized the necessity of commingling fluids as being the spiritual element that is sex.
Okay.
This emphasis on fluids extended to one of his most lucrative businesses, which was his trade in magic mirrors, crystal balls, and other scrying implements. His most lucrative items were the mirrors that Randolph himself consecrated, usually using a layer of sexual excretion and hash in between the mirrors layers.
I'm going to need to pause here. He was jerking off on mirrors.
I think like in between the backing
hash.
I think in between the backing and the mirror part of the mirror, he would create a layer of fluids and hash.
Of sacred sexual fluids and hash.
So this is how he consecrated his best implements.
Hats all the way off for him finding a way to make money that way.
I know. Seriously. Quite an interesting life.
But masturbation was evil at the time, so how did he just called them secretions and left it at that?
Yeah, I think he usually had, I don't know, I don't know the exact mechanics.
Listeners, I can tell he regrets inviting me here today.
he wrote a lot about how the secretions needed to mix, so I don't know if somehow he got women's secretions as well.
Lady secretions.
Sorry, lady secretions, as we like to call them. Hard to say. Hard to say, Jess.
Please come better prepared next time.
All right, next story. This is The Living Machine. The Universalist minister John Murray Speer from 1804 to 1884 came under the influence of Andrew Jackson Davis by way of his spirit of his progressive causes. He was a supporter of abolition, temperance, and the repeal of the death penalty. He moved to a spiritualist community on the western edge of New York and came in contact with a league of dissents of with a league of deceased gentlemen known as the Association of Beneficence.
Oh, so fancy.
I know. They were experts in their various fields, and they included Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and the founder of Universalism and Speer's namesake, John Murray.
You know they wouldn't have hung out together.
No way. Not after death. 2 years later, Speer had engaged a group of followers in building a new motor described by these illustrious spirits that would push civilization along. Unfortunately, no plans or images of the motor survive. Great loss to history.
Yeah. You know?
The machine was supposed to be a perpetual motion machine and a spiritual telegraph in one.
Ooh.
So it brought the industrial dreams of progressives. You know, we talked about Oneida and everyone thinking that invention could free people from labor.
Yeah.
It brought these industrial dreams into combination with this animal magnetism idea from spiritualism. From such engines, mediums would be able to send accurate messages in real time across the country, as well as receive divine communications. And so in a certain way, this does prefigure like wireless telegraphs or even the internet, something like that.
We really could have used this.
Yeah. First, the machine was brought to life through a, quote, wombonic process. And I can't tell you any more about that either. Through a wombonic process that involved a woman acting out childbirth in the presence of the machine. So essentially spiritually giving birth to the machine.
Okay.
While this supposedly brought parts of the machine to life, a more direct process would be needed. And so a sex magician, who was probably Randolph, was brought in to have sex in front of the machine.
So the machine needed to be created first before the birthing.
Got I think
it.
So.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it needed to be conceived through this fluid mingling thing.
I see. They really were into their fluids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Especially the men. In 1854, the community was invaded by a mob, and they destroyed the machine as well as any records of it. So.
Ugh, what a loss.
I know. 3 years later, Speer organized a convention in Buffalo and two in Ohio that celebrated free love through the prism of eugenics.
Not eugenics again.
No, it's back. He championed the idea that free and loving sexual intercourse could attract higher souls into the children who were created, which would in turn uplift humanity. The method for achieving these holier unions involved granting women happiness, health, and free choice. So he supported contraception and premarital sex as ways to free women.
All right, I'm back. He's got me.
The next year, his first harmonial child was born. This wasn't his child. It was a child born under the aegis of his group.
Oh, okay.
And at this point, Speer shifted his focus to digging a hole. Spirits promised untold treasures hidden by the part frog antediluvian human ancestors who had previously lived in the area. The community bored 150 feet into the earth before flooding from the water table made it impossible to continue without investing in much more serious machinery.
This was not a turn I was expecting. I was on their level. They were going in the right direction, and now we're 150 feet looking for treasure?
Yeah. Promised okay. by frog people.
Promised by frog. Right.
He left New York around the time that the Comstock laws were passed because that defined his work as pornographic because he was spreading information about contraception that was considered pornographic under the Comstock laws. And so he fled New York in 1872 and he retired shortly thereafter and went back to being a minister and then retired from the public eye.
Did he go to Utah?
No, Utah. but was definitely kicked out of New York. Yeah. Mm. All right, this is The Builder. On an unassuming street, in the small township of Georgetown, stands a unique piece of spiritualist history, the Spirit House. The house that Timothy Brown built has an overwhelming roof. Three layers of entablature overhang each other and appear to drip with ornamental carvings that resemble cake icing or Victorian lace. Mm. The effect is very similar to a tiered wedding cake. This grand roof sits atop a fairly formulaic colonial-style manor house. The other notable features of it are the columns along the facade carved with a pattern of identical scalloping.
Please tell me you have a photo.
You should absolutely take a look. In the blog post, I'll put my photo. These are photos that I took myself.
Oh, wow. It's really, really beautiful and ornate. Yeah. And it almost looks like scales. Like the outside of the building has these...
Yeah, like, so the scalloping that he did has this interesting...
Oh, is it scalloping?
Yeah, those are all little scallops. While this is not the only building that was directly designed by spirits at the time of its creation, it's likely the only remaining example of supernatural architecture from the burned over district. The only other thing I can think of is the shaker chairs were supposed to be directly designed by spirits.
Oh.
Local myths would have you believe that Brown had never picked up a hammer before the spirits gave him intricate instructions about the house's construction. But no such spiritual architects were needed. However, Timothy Brown, he lived from 1807 to 1885, was not only a gifted architect, he invented a machine for making cheese hoops and built furniture, walls, and very likely his first farmhouse.
Should I know what a cheese hoop is?
No, I had to look up what cheese hoops were. He created a hoop for hooping cheese. I don't know, it's like a cottage cheese thing that was popular. Okay. It's kind of hard to find these days, I think it's like a cottage cheese.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, it required a lot of metallurgical work. He had to find the right alloys to make this thing in the right shape, and so it would have involved a lot of machining. The scalloping of the Spirit House suggests that he even built a machine to create that precise pattern. Mm. So even in the architecture, it looks like he was building machines to help build things.
It looks crazy because it looks modern in a way because of the scalloping.
It does, yeah. Yeah, except for the monster Victorian roof that then hangs above it.
I like it.
He said he received the design fully formed in his head from the spirits, like the Shakers did with their art and furniture, and then he set about constructing it. A large single room on the upper floor served as an assembly hall for town meetings, plays, trials, temperance meetings, and, of course, seances. In 1874, Brown added to this by purchasing a disused Presbyterian church, moving the church down the street, and then adjoining it to his house.
Was that the best way to go about doing that, I wonder?
Instead of just building a new...
Given his talent for stone scalloping, was that the best way?
But sadly, this piece of history, while it still stands, it is in need of rescue. A protracted and confusing custody battle has played out all over the 20th century, and for several decades now, the house has been in a derelict condition. Its various stewards have jealously guarded the house, but haven't been able to secure the funds to properly restore it.
Oh, no, that's so sad. It's really a beautiful building.
It really is. In 2011, the house was nearly bought by a historical society. They were called the Spirit House Society. The current owner, Resurrection Demaculengan, bought it with a large cash offer at the last moment. The website abandoned.com claims that the house has been vacant since 2018, but when I went, that was very much not the case. The owner was very much there.
You met Resurrection?
I met Resurrection.
Yes.
She came out yelling at us for taking pictures of her private property, and she said we were racist for being there. She was like, what, you think you're white? You can just walk into my house and take photos? Like, oh.
Wait, you weren't in the house,
No,
were
we
you?
Didn't go in the house.
Okay.
No. It was a little confusing. She first came to the door, and she was like, you can just come in and take photos. And we were like, oh, great, thanks. And then she was like, you think this is funny? You can't just come to someone's house and take photos of it. And then we slowly realized that she was telling us to get the hell off of her property.
Oh, how confusing and terrifying.
Yeah, it was a very unpleasant run-in. And based on reviews of various things online, my experience is not unique. That's pretty much the Spirit House experience.
She's got
now.
Bad Google reviews.
Yeah, generally, like, there's one review about how she, like, they approached the house from the back instead of from the front, and she accused them of stealing things from it and various. Oh, wow. She seems like not a great person to tangle with.
But this building, I mean, it looks very grand in the photos.
Yeah.
And it was built as sort of like a community house, but she's living there.
Yeah, she got it, and she has taken over $5,000 from New York State to supposedly keep it up and restore
right.
it and stuff.
Yeah.
And so she's got all of this posting outside of the house that's like, yes, I can take money from the state without... while still living in it as a private residence and not opening it as a museum. But it's weird, and it seems pretty clear that she's not entirely mentally stable. I think the term I'm going to use. She's covered kind of the outside of the house and all of the windows with various writing about how the place rightfully belongs to her, and you know, how she was chosen to be the steward of this place and how she has no obligation to share it with other people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Also so sad because it won't stand forever if someone doesn't take care of it.
I know. And the concern is that it's not in a good state. I know that the state has attempted to condemn it before in the past. And
oh,
so
wow.
It's like hanging on by a thread between like the point where it'll have to just be condemned and torn down.
Oh, no. And it's not safe for her to be there probably.
No,
Resurrection,
probably
get it together.
I know. But she seems to be living inside of the house, which at least means that like she's keeping it like basically together. Hmm. I was more concerned when I thought that it had been abandoned in 2018.
Yeah.
But obviously it would be in a much better state if she would open it as a museum, for example, or if she would work with scholars, whoever, to get information about the place, or if she would sell it, get rid of the place, sell it to stewards who can properly keep it up. So
just do what, you know, fancy British aristocracy do. Live on the first floor, rent out the second floor.
Yeah.
Done.
So if there's any call to action in this episode, it's try and put pressure on New York State or whatever bodies that be to try and get this house better preserved. It'll be a loss to spiritualist history if this place falls apart.
And no one wants to lose the Spirit House.
No. It's a beautiful house. It's crazy. Take a look at it online. It's bizarre. All right, this section is Koresh and the Age of Aquarius.
Yes.
Cyrus Reed Teed, he lived from 1839 to 1908, was a proto-flat earther. He believed that we live inside of the hollow earth, and that the sky and star phenomenon we see are just a reflection on the interior of the globe.
Huh.
Yeah. Cyrus was from a rising industrial family, but he chose to go into medicine instead of business. He was not yet 20 when he declared to his uncle, quote, "I am Jesus Christ. I see the whole world. It is opened before me."
Sounds like a great guy.
Teed graduated with an MD in 1868 and dove into a career of eclectic, natural, and botanical medicine. I know that he had a big sign outside of his practice that said, those who deal drugs deal death, referring to the pharmacy down the street, because he was more of a spiritual and botanical healer.
Yikes.
Yeah. Around 1869, he began to experience intense visions of the female god. Cousins noticed a halo of light enveloping him, and his wife noticed two cherubim on the wall brackets shortly after he had this direct experience with God.
On the wall brackets?
Mm-hmm, these little cherubs.
Got it.
Like you see in all Renaissance painting.
Of course.
At this point, his normal medical practice ended, as did his marriage to his wife. She got consumption at this time. She survived. She just had consumption.
What? That... And they got divorced?
No, he just left.
Oh.
You don't divorce people in the 1800s.
Sorry.
You stay married forever and never talk about it. At this, he practiced medicine sporadically on the road while he developed new ideas.
So his wife got consumption. He just got out of town.
Yeah.
Okay.
He became and left his practice as well.
Okay.
So Godwin, the author of Upstate Cauldron, who I've been quoting throughout all these episodes, mm-hmm. he describes the revelation like this. "Most children are not engendered deliberately, but are the accidents of lustful intercourse. The vileness of the average male, soaked in nicotine and alcohol, passes through his sperm cells to infect the next generation, and woman has every right to protect herself from him.
Amen.
Teed believed that through celibacy and, Noise's favorite, the male continence, woman could be freed from focusing on the mortal world. And Teed's contribution to this is this alchemical idea that she can then metamorphosize herself into psychic energy. By being freed from the material concerns of being a woman, she can be her true self, which is pure psychic energy.
And, like, pass on to the next life or become a god? Like, what do you do with your psychic energy?
It's a good question, and I'm not entirely sure.
Okay. But it's, I mean, it sounds cool, but...
Essentially, it's another yet another one of these progressive apocalyptic ideas that this is going to free us all, and we're going to change completely into a better people.
Okay. Only the women, though, right?
I think the women are going to help the rest of us.
Okay.
Going to uplift us all.
Of course we are.
You still got to carry men on your back. he described alchemy of the soul, the transformation from the mortal to the immortal, which he said no human had achieved since Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ was the only person who had transmuted himself in this way that he was describing. He developed various societies around his ideas. And these followed the now familiar pattern of growing fame and then being run out of town. In 1891, he swapped out his name Cyrus for the Persian original that's mentioned in the Bible, Koresh. Mm. He published extensively over the next decade on social, spiritual, and geological matters. He opposed greed and money. He supported radical bodily autonomy for women. And he knew from his biological studies that the world was, in fact, a giant cell about 100 miles thick with 17 layers that represented cosmological, alchemical, and social significance. These are the three things he stood for.
One cell.
Yeah, the whole thing is a cell.
Okay.
That we're living inside of.
Right.
In many ways, he was a throwback to classical cosmology, this idea of the sky as a concave enclosure that intimately interacts with us, the movements of it. This is all cornerstone stuff of Greek and Roman belief in medicine.
Yeah.
His own time, he said, straddled the age of Pisces and Aquarius, and that the age of Aquarius would be heralded by the transmutation of the human body into the spiritual energy. So when women accomplish this, we would then enter the age of Aquarius.
Which we are currently in now, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so. Yeah. I mean, if the fifth element, if the musical Hair is true, and I believe it is, then yes, this is the age of Aquarius. This initiated a brief romance with the Shakers in the 1980s, because he believed in this female god. And various ideas of like transmuting into spiritual energy they were really into. But they soon rejected him for claiming to be the third manifestation of Jesus Christ after Anne Lee, of course, being the second Jesus.
Yeah, you're going to get kicked out of a dinner party if you say that.
Yeah. So he and his remaining followers then moved to Naples, Florida, where they conducted an extraordinary experiment.
Oh, God.
Over several months, they erected the rectilineator on the beach.
That sounds terrifying.
it's not very impressive, but it's got a cool name, the rectilineator. It had 12-foot posts that supposedly projected a perfectly straight line. So he began 128 inches above the sand on the beach, and after 4 1/8 miles, it touched the sea, which proves that the world is concave, not convex. So if the world was round, you expect the sea to get further and further away. But instead, the sea came up to touch the rectilineator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that definitely checks out.
Yeah. As to how you can come to that result, I'm not sure, because pretty much since the Greeks, we've known that the world is round and moves through some kind of space. But his experiment proved that the world is actually convex.
Why does the name Koresh sound so familiar to me?
Because... for the essentially the same reason, about 100 years later, you get David Koresh adopting that name.
Oh, my God,
name.
Yes!
Yeah. So this was a guy in the late 1800s calling himself Koresh, preaching the imminent age of Aquarius. I think that's very strange. He died in 1908 without achieving the immortality that he claimed.
Ugh.
And he was buried in a mausoleum that washed out to sea in 1921.
Oh, no.
In 1961, the last four members of the Koreshian Society donated the grounds to the state of Florida. And it remains a state park, the Koreshian State Historic Site, to this day.
Wait, what happened to the rectilineator?
I think they just scrapped it.
Oh,
I don't.
No.
I think other scientists didn't get on board with the world being.
Someone who's listening, please reuse that name in some way.
It's my next album. The Rectilineator. Oh, it'd be a good band name, actually. The Rectilineators.
Yeah, it's like funny and also filthy at the same time.
It does seem a little dirty. Okay, this section is the New Age. So I won't do a full survey of New Age religion here. It's outside the scope of what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
But I will mention that by the 1890s, all the ideas that are part of New Age were present now in the burned over district. And these are the ideas that are what people generally mean when they say that they're spiritual today. When you talk to someone, they say, well, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. It often is some combination of these late spiritualist beliefs that they're referring to.
Mm.
So from spiritualism, New Age inherited the idea that souls are free-flowing things that attach and detach from physical reality and that continue on. In most conceptions, souls continue to become better after death, whether that be more holy or pure or happy or knowledgeable. Building on Andrew Jackson Davis, New Age holds that the same energy that animates our lives also exists in minerals and stars and natural life. There's a lot of focus on this is what the crystal healing thing comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the animating energy is the same between the two of us. In many cases, it inherits the utopian Protestant belief from the burned over district that adherence to certain ways of living and thinking can not only improve you and cure disease, they can also remake the whole world in a more harmonious way.
Yeah.
And this is something that I've heard a million times at various yoga practices and stuff. Not
for
only
sure.
Is yoga and settling the mind good for you, it's good for the world. It's going to change everything.
And that self-improvement is world improvement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a late spiritualism idea that became, that is, I think, an intimately American idea now.
Yeah.
Information about the East had tantalized Victorians and had been incorporated and appropriated by various spiritualists. So I had mentioned the breathing technique of Thomas Lake Harris. This echoed yogic breath practice, although he warned that doing it in the yogic way will make you polytheistic and crazy.
Don't let those other gods in.
Yeah. And the practice called male continence that we've been referring to. This is the same thing that's existed in tantric sex for millennia.
Yeah.
By the turn of the century, many spiritualists had turned to India to inform their worldview, had started adopting yogis as their spiritual leaders. Right? Is that what they're called?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. around this time, people began to talk about themselves as reincarnations of Eastern souls.
Oh.
Yeah. So from this milieu, various Eastern-inspired but American practices have developed, most prominent among them probably yoga, the American style of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
New Age also inherited tarot from occult traditions that were adjacent to a lot of the things we've been talking about.
I was hoping we would get to tarot.
Tarot cards themselves represent a fascination and fetishism of foreign religion. Tarot decks and playing cards started as the same thing, and they became differentiated in the late Middle Ages and early modern period. Mediterranean traders picked up this card game from the Islamic world, most likely from Egyptian traders.
Oh, interesting. I thought they were born in Italy. I thought that was it became a game or like coalesced in Italy.
So Italian sailors were the first like Europeans to start picking it up.
Gotcha.
And it contained imagery from Persian and from Sufi mystical traditions.
Oh.
Mystical traditions that were already thriving in the East.
How fascinating.
Yeah. By the 1750s, tarot decks had become differentiated from playing cards. These were now two separate things. And by the end of that century, decks used for cartomancy, the reading of future using cards, increasingly featured Egyptian-style designs. And this was spurred by an occult fascination with ancient Egyptian mysticism. Egypt was coming much more fully into the Western mind at this point. And because of associations between tarot reading and Romani people. Romani people were at that time called gypsies because they supposedly came from Egypt originally. This was a common myth.
I never knew that, actually.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
So gypsy is actually short for Egyptian initially. Cartomancy came into late spiritualism as one of these ways to know the supernatural. And it has continued to be an important tool for New Age believers and still exists within spiritualism today.
Who doesn't love a good tarot deck?
Yeah. New Age is a term that's not used as much anymore. It was much more popular in the 60s and 70s. But it permeates the spiritual landscape of America today. And it includes holistic healing, yoga, meditation, astrology, tarot, interest in Native American and non-European religions, vegetarianism, deep ecology, self-improvement, animal communication, Tai Chi, bodywork, and other beliefs.
All my favorite things.
All the great things. This constellation of beliefs has become, for the non-Christian American, as well accepted as spiritualism was 100 years ago.
Yeah.
If you're not a Christian, this is sort of the assumptive spiritualism that you're going to have.
We all so want like some kind of ritual, right? It gives you some kind of ritual to cling to that feels special and holy and ancient.
Yes. Now you know how most of those became touchstones of America.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. This section is Boomer Mecca.
I'm scared already.
So if the world does have ley lines and psychic hotspots, as New Age suggests, the American hotspot drifted from New York to Chicago and then to California as the 20th century unfolded. However, one last notable spiritual event shook upstate New York, and this one happened in 1969. Starting in the late 1930s, a community grew up around Bishop William H.F. Brothers. A bishop of various Catholic and Orthodox churches, Brothers never found a permanent spiritual home, and he preached a combination of progressive social ideology along with universalist Christianity in this sort of strange formal mix of all these Catholic and Orthodox ideas. Throughout the 50s and 60s, he proved himself to be a friend not only to rural workers, but to progressive upstate vacationers. As the cultural tides turned, he became a supporter and a patron saint of the New York hippies.
Of course.
Yeah. His religious services, while they were formal and very traditional, it was very eclectic. It was a strange combination of things. And it became a meeting place for progressives, both young and old, and both urban and rural. This community attracted the attention of the 60s countercultural movement, and in 1969, in a field outside of Brothers Parish called Woodstock, a music festival seemed to unite social and spiritual concerns for a new generation.
That's wild.
Yeah. But this festival has been elaborated upon elsewhere.
Yes.
I won't linger any further on it.
Never heard of it.
And while Woodstock would be a good end if we were explicitly talking about New Age and spiritualism, I have a more fitting end for our wider tour of New York and this burned over district.
Lay it on me.
So here we go. This is the last bit. The American Witch Queen.
Oh, I'm already really invested.
So let me tell you one last story. In some ways, this story is more fantastical than the others, but in other ways, I find it much more believable than some of these. See if you can spot the ways it merges all of these events and forces that we've been talking about. This is a story that you're quite familiar with. Once upon a time, a little girl of 6 woke up in a strange land to discover that she had freed a race of enslaved people by killing the local tyrant completely by accident. She is immediately proclaimed to be the most powerful sorceress in the world. She, however, only wants to go home. A witch instructs her that she must find the only person more powerful than she, an enigmatic leader who everyone loves and looks up to.
Oh.
Yeah. You got it. So along the way, she picks up three followers, three men who consider themselves to be deeply flawed. The first is an agricultural worker, an absolute country bumpkin, who is ashamed of how dumb he is. He has a serious imposter syndrome, and he thinks of himself as a stuffed shirt, a straw man. The second is a woodsman and a craftsman, a member of the booming industrial class. He was intimidated to stop pursuing the woman of his dreams, and now he fears that he's become heartless. He overcompensates by being incredibly sentimental at all times. And the third is a guy with no self-confidence. He's a petty tyrant, and we first meet him bullying someone half his size in an attempt to look big. He thinks he's terrifying, but he's really just a big scaredy cat. When our gang finally reaches the capital city, they see everything as bright, beautiful, and gleaming. They manage to meet the enigmatic leader, and he shows them wild visions of their greatest fears before demanding that they destroy his greatest enemy. Only then will he make them whole. Somehow, the girl defeats this second tyrant, and the four return to demand their prizes. After being ignored and shrugged off with excuses, they force their way into the leader's hall. The girl then discovers that this man was all smoke and mirrors. Mm. When they finally see his true face, he's just a sad old man who's just as afraid of them as he is of everything else. He's not the great wizard he was made out to be. In fact, he's from Omaha. It turns out that his power rested upon simple parlor tricks all along.
Mm.
But stranger still, we learn that he never intended to be a charlatan. He'd been forced into this role. You see, just like Dorothy, Oz had arrived from the skies and was mistaken for greatness. Nevertheless, the gang insists that he keep his promise. So, he gets a pile of straw to give the Scarecrow for brains, crafts a small velvet heart for the Tin Man, and gives the Cowardly Lion some bad-tasting medicine that he says will give him courage. When he's finished, though, Oz feels ashamed. Quote, "How can I help being a humbug when all these people make me do things they know can't be done? It was easy to make the Scarecrow and the Lion and the Woodman happy because they imagine that I can do anything. But it will take more than imagination to carry Dorothy back to Kansas, and I'm not sure it can be done."
Ooh, didn't realize that the Wizard of Oz was this much of a scorching commentary.
I know. In fact, he's not able to do it. Even in this last hope, no man can help Dorothy. The pompous buffoon flies off in his balloon without her. It's only at this point that they take off the emerald spectacles they've been given, and they discover that the capital city is ordinary. It was just these lenses that gave it its emerald color and its sparkle.
Mm.
Dorothy now must turn to a woman and to a witch to achieve her wish and to return to her loving family back home. And since I'm going to cut it out of the recording earlier, I'll now say, yeah, this is the Wizard of Oz as told by Frank Baum, or at least my telling of Frank Baum's telling of the Wizard of Oz, the original children's book.
I totally guessed it. Please don't.
Yeah.
Please don't cut that out.
Well, we have to let the people at home guess. Lyman Frank Baum was born in a town outside of Syracuse in 1856, and he lived through the later stages of this burned over district time.
Mm.
He lived in New York until the age of 32 and married Maud Gage, who was a daughter of Matilda Jocelyn Gage, who was a foremost feminist of the time. Baum's magical world was steeped in progressive and feminist causes, and it reflects the wild spirituality of rural New York and its eccentric leaders and easily led followers.
Yeah.
It features abolition. When Dorothy first lands, she's told by the Munchkins, quote, "We are so grateful to you for having killed the Wicked Witch of the East, for setting our people free from bondage." So specifically, they were enslaved people. And a disclaimer noting that witches can be good, no doubt inspired by the feminist Gages, who held that witch burnings had been a tool of sexist oppression.
Mm-hmm.
Even when the people of Oz are not enslaved by one of the Wicked Witches, they demand to be ruled by this flim-flam man. And I guess that never changes, I suppose. It's fitting that Oz lives on in stage and screen, because Baum's first career was performing, writing, and producing plays. after his theater burned down in New York during a production of his play Matches.
Stop.
That's not a joke. Stop. The Bombs moved to South Dakota and then to Chicago, where he found success publishing articles and magazines about storefront design and painting. This was his major career, was how do you make storefronts their absolute best?
Oh, wow.
Now 35, Baum wrote The Wonderful Wizard of Oz to instant success. Although in the year that he published it, he also published one of his greatest guides to storefront painting, which he probably thought was going to be by far the greater seller of the two.
Big year for him.
Yeah. The Wizard of Oz remained a best-selling children's book for the next 2 years, and he ultimately wrote 13 stories that take place in Oz.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a whole world that he fleshed out of Oz. 2 years after the book's publication, Baum helped create a musical stage version for adults, and it changed many parts of the story, and Baum had little control over it. And yet, it was successful, and the comic duo of the Tin Man and the Scarecrow found instant fame and became an instant beloved comic duo in the U.S.
Oh, that's sad. So he wasn't happy with how it came out.
Yeah, we can only imagine his chagrin seeing his dream of the stage fulfilled by this bastard play that had been taken out of his control. Yeah. And apparently, it deviates drastically from the original source. He wrote his next Oz book specifically with the stage in mind, but he couldn't stage it because the first play was still running because it was so popular. So that play never got produced.
He was too good for his own good.
Yeah, essentially. And he continued writing Oz sequels and staging them for the rest of his life with little success. But he kept trying to get this to be a big stage franchise.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. By my count, including the ones written by Baum himself, there have been 17 adaptations, 18 direct sequels and plays, and 16 reimaginings. And by
which
reimaginings, I'm including the 1987 play by the Chicago AIDS Educational Theater called The Wizard of AIDS.
No.
Yeah.
Too soon.
And one of the novels in Stephen King's Dark Tower series is a telling of The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Oz has lived on in the collective memory as well as or better than most of these movements that we've talked about. Like, it's up there with Mormons in terms of, or perhaps even beats out Mormons in terms of cultural impact.
Yeah, I would say so.
This can be credited in large part to the 1939 musical film adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
This film took inspiration from the illustrations in the original book, and it defined many of the canonical features that we think of with Oz. So the two good witches were merged into one, named Glinda.
Mm-hmm.
The Tin Woodsman's past as a human who had chopped off all of his limbs one by one, that was removed from the story. And the Wicked Witch became green, and her cloak became black instead of white. It's explicit in the story that sorcerers always wear white.
Oh.
Yeah. The Tin Woodsman's backstory being dropped, I think, is interesting because in The Wizard of Oz, there's a foreword written by Baum where he says, you know, children's stories up to this point have been used for moral tales and therefore are terrifying for children to read. And I'm going to write a story that's purely happy, purely educational, and purely entertaining because the child of today no longer needs terrifying morals. And he tells the story of a woodsman getting his axe cursed so that it chops off his limbs one by one. He replaces each limb with a tin counterpart until he's a tin man.
You may have a little bit missed the mark there with your goal.
It's wild. And then one other thing is early in their journeys, it talks about how the scarecrow doesn't need to eat or sleep or anything. And so they stop off for this one journey, and the scarecrow is just standing in the corner. And Dorothy's like, aren't you going to sleep? And he's like, I have no need to. And so he just stands in the corner and watches Dorothy all night.
No, not okay. No.
Some creepy stuff.
Wonder they rewrote it for him.
Yeah, there are certain parts
that had some issues.
Got shuffled around a little. Yeah. Oz gained special significance in the gay community as well.
Oh, Judy.
Yep. In Baum sequels, Dorothy frequently reminds characters to be accepting of themselves and of her other, quote, queer companions. A major figure, Ozma, lived all of her childhood as a boy due to a curse to keep her from being queen of her kingdom. When the curse is lifted, she becomes female, but she only remembers being a boy when she was a child. So starting in book two, Frank Baum's Oz is ruled by a trans witch.
I love it.
Yeah. The The film was adopted not long after its release by gay communities as a representation of the journey of coming out. Dorothy escapes from drab gray Kansas into a Technicolor land full of chosen friends who she teaches to accept themselves instead of trying to get someone else to change them.
Yeah.
Over the Rainbow, that song at the beginning of it written for that film, expresses the experience that most young queer people feel when they're coming out. And that's one of the reasons why the rainbow is a queer symbol.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I knew the Wizard of Oz was so important in that, in like the LGBTQ community, but I didn't realize that's where the rainbow came from.
Yeah, it's one of, it's not like the only reason why the rainbow is a gay symbol, but this is one of the connections because it was so near and dear. Over the Rainbow was so near and dear to the queer community of the 40s and 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Judy Garland herself became a queer icon, and by the 1960s, she was playing sold-out shows to gay audiences who identified with her turbulent life and her break from her possessive managers. They saw parallels in their own lives there. A love of Judy Garland became such a touchstone of gay culture that it became used by queer people to identify each other in a time when simply outing yourself could be life-threatening. And so this term, the friend of Dorothy, became the gay slang.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, there was at one point so many, like the FBI caught wind to so many people amongst their ranks who were being referred to as friends of Dorothy that they did an investigation into finding out who Dorothy was. And apparently, that was quietly shut down and put to the corner of the FBI hilarious. At some point. Yeah.
Someone please dig up that file.
Yeah. I think at some point, a gay guy was like, so
a little bit awkward, but
and even after Garland's death, her daughter Liza Minnelli is now a major gay icon for many reasons in her own right, but being the daughter of Judy Garland, certainly one of them.
If you've ever seen Cabaret, you'll understand why Liza has earned that title on her own.
I read some quote from her where she was like, I should have known that I was always going to be part of the gay community because I was the daughter of Judy Garland and a gay man. Oz continues to see popular revivals. 1978's The Wiz, which the screenplay is written by Joel Schumacher.
Oh.
It's a little fun fact. It starred Diana Ross and Michael Jackson, and it had Richard Pryor in it, and it was an urban reimagining of the story. There's a lot to be said about The Wiz that I'm not going to touch here. But let's just say that while it was a commercial and critical failure when it came out, it has since become a cult classic. In more recent years, Wicked, a reimagining / prequel with the Wicked Witch of the West. She's now been named Elphaba and given a whole backstory.
This one's my favorite.
Yes, this one's captured a whole new crop of impressionable theater kids into the world of Oz.
It's so good.
Yeah. The Stephen Schwartz musical is now the second highest grossing musical ever. It's second only to The Lion King. It was first produced in 2003, and it continues to run on Broadway as of 2021. In this sense, The Wizard of Oz has returned from the sound stages of California to its rightful home, the theaters of New York. I think The Wizard of Oz shows us what it means to struggle through a landscape of up-jumped leaders and of credulous followers. Only with a strong sense of skepticism and self-confidence is Dorothy able to navigate safely. Mm. It emphasizes, The Wizard of Oz emphasizes kindness and understanding, even for charlatans, because they, too, after all, fulfill a role that's been demanded of them. Which is this need to believe in someone or something greater than yourself. I think it also shows how an intolerance for bullshit can inoculate you against the cult leaders like the ones we've described, because Dorothy is not taken in by Oz at all. However, this is just one way of viewing the story. In Upstate Cauldron, Godwin argues that Oz features many of the signs and symbols of the occult and of theosophy, and that it might represent the Summerland that's described by spiritualists as this happy place where deceased children roam.
I like your imagining of it, though, where it's our collective processing of this whole time.
Yeah, I think so.
We're going to skim off all the good stuff and just, like, emotionally process the rest.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, I think you can see a culture's art and somewhat as their way of as a sociologically processing, you know, the things that it's been through. And so, yeah, I do think the bomb really put into words the experience of this burned over district time.
Mm-hmm.
All of the original Oz stories have since passed into public domain. So now they're free to use. And generation after generation of Americans have reinterpreted and reimagined the story. And we've kept it fresh by changing things that we wanted to change over time. But at its heart, I think Oz remains a story about the burned over district, a place where Americans took God into their own hands and radically reimagined what Christianity and spirituality were all about.
For the better, I would say, ultimately.
Definitely. I don't know. Why for the better? In that it's not Puritan anymore. I'll give you that.
Yeah. It's more flexible. I think it opened lots of interesting doors. Like the connections you made are, would we have spiritualism today without this phase?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
You seem very skeptical.
I'm skeptical of how much of this stuff has just become accepted by Americans as like the way that the world works. Mm. Which, as I've shown here, like that just, it kind of got built into our DNA as Americans. I think it absolutely speaks to our hubris that we were like, oh, everyone can personally experience God and every person can directly say,
it's a very American what the world thought, is.
And so I think in a lot of ways it does feed into our, well, there's like the progressive view of like the world is for us, that it caters to us and that we're like, by changing your mind, you can change the world around you. I think that can be a powerful idea for a lot of people, but can also be a really delusional idea for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It can lead a lot of people to waste a lot of time and energy on things. But I don't know. As a musician and writer and everything, I've kind of lived my life on the borders of the spirit. I've been to a gong bath. I've done my share of chakra opening and healing and stuff like that. And I know I do always kind of come away from it of two minds, where it's like, yes, this is a cathartic experience for people, and this can be a way for people to process their traumas and the things that are holding them down.
Yeah.
And it can also become this like lead weight that people put an infinite amount of money into and become really convinced about these things. And, you know, there was like The Secret, right? Where like, if you think it and you believe it and you want it to happen, it comes true.
Yeah. Which is now manifestation. That's its new.
Yeah.
That's its new form.
Which again, I think that like can be really powerful
for
people, but it can also be really diluted as well and can cause you to, you know, put a lot of dreams in something where you're not actually materially changing your circumstances.
Yeah.
And it's taking energy away from actually changing your life.
I mean, I completely agree with you, and I'm of two minds as well, but I think that it's just human nature to want to tell these kinds of stories and to put our own problems external to us and to put it into the hands of like another being or whatever. Like we're hardwired to tell these stories. So to me, this is the less damaging version of it, to like find ways to tell outside the story. Of power feels like growth, even though it's like can lead you down bad roads as well,
versus the story of a endless patriarch that wants you to rot in hell.
Crazy why I as a woman might not be so into that, but
and then as we discussed with the progressives, it was often a way of reimagining social situations as well, and that if you can get away from the Puritan God, you can also kind of get away from some of these defenses of slavery and patriarchy that have existed in Western civ, you know, as long as Christianity has.
And I just love that the door got cracked open to the idea of religious personal experience in general, that alternative methods of experiencing the divine are acceptable.
Mm.
I think that's really positive.
Yeah. Yeah. And if nothing else, I mean, it's definitely, I don't know, it reflects society. This is also the time when America goes from being a republic of very rich merchant class to increasingly a democracy as voting laws are expanded, and then eventually ex-slaves, black people become eligible voters, and then finally in time women become eligible voters. So I think it also reflects the democratization of the spiritual realm as we are politically opening up our country.
Yeah, exactly.
So kind of a spiritual mirror of ourselves, I think.
Yeah. We, as Americans, are experimenting with everything, including your religion. So.
All right. Thanks for joining me, Jess.
Oh, such a pleasure, as always.
Great.
Right.
This concludes a four-part, six-hour series on the burned-over district, and for me, the culmination of years of research. So first of all, thank you for listening if you made it this far. I hope you found these stories as strange and illuminating as I did. I want to thank Jocelyn Godwin for writing an exhaustively researched and very readable history of this time and place. Upstate Cauldron is head and shoulders above anything else on the subject. Thank you for writing it. It's worth reading if you want more info on any of these topics or if you want to examine the source where most of my claims came from. Godwin is very interested in and knowledgeable about the occult, and he provides a more informed, and I would say a more credulous, account of the mysticism and esotericism that's at play in the stories of the Burned Over District. As I mentioned, I was able to road trip around New York some while I was researching this. If you are in New York, visit the Yates County History Center in Penn Yan. They have most of the remaining artifacts from the Public Universal Friend, and they were very helpful in my research. It's a great museum to support. It's also worth visiting the Oneida Community Mansion House in Oneida. It's a beautiful building with an extensive museum, and it operates as a hotel in case you want to stay in a 19th century sex cult mansion. I would also ask if you live in New York, look into the Spirit House in Georgetown and support preservation efforts. That site would be a real shame to lose. And lastly, and most of all, I want to thank the parents of my partner, Caitlin, Susan and Russ. Thanks for putting us up when we came to town, for supporting me in my research and listening to large portions of the script while I was working on it, for lending me your car for the Shakers Day that I took, and most of all for raising such a wonderful daughter. As I worked on this and bounced ideas off of her, I realized how much she embodies the optimism and wonder of the Burned Over District, and she is, after all, a child of Del Mar, New York. Caitlin has committed her life to the idea that dedicated, sustained belief and action can fundamentally change society and improve the world. She carries on the progressive belief that hard work and hard discussions can create justice where justice has never existed in the past or has never been accessible to certain people. It takes a really special person to build a career in life around that belief. So I want to thank you, Susan and Russ, for raising someone with her optimism and integrity. Thanks for listening.